So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
The Rocket, Owen Hart, I don't believe. Austin 316 says I just whipped your ass.
That's my shot.
The opportunity.
Stepping stone.
Great things. The most grueling.
Brutal tournament.
16 men.
One winner.
Four rounds.
Four victories.
To become the king of the ring.
Test.
Rob Van Dam.
Chris Jericho.
Brock Lesnar.
Winning king of the ring. Give Test something he deserves.
The winner of the king of the ring gets a title shot at SummerSlam.
The chance to become the undisputed champion.
This is going to be one hell of a summer for Rob Van Dam.
The next undisputed champ will be the next big thing. Brock Lesnar, the king of the ring.
King of the ring.
Ring. I takes you on a ride. The ride of your life. On a ride. The ride of your life.
I always ask for more.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock, and I'm joined by the returning Waiting, who returned on Monday night, actually. You actually only missed one show, but this is your Review Away proper return.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yeah, I'm back. Surprise.
It's great reviewing Raw with you most weeks, Way, but I like going back in time with you.
Really?
You are my time-traveling partner, so it's great to have you.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah, I don't mind it. It's okay.
What did you do on your big week off? Did you sit back? Did you listen to our show? Did you even download it?
I did, of course.
What did we review?
Listen to the entire show. Halloween Havoc 1990.
All right. Just finding out.
Yeah.
Well, today.
Yeah, it was great. Great show.
Well, we're reviewing something completely different today. It is The King of the Ring 2002, which I knew there was a lot going on at this time. I didn't realize how much until I went back, watched the show, and all the craziness.
A very appropriate review.
This, I think we could have done a month's worth of Review Aways for that June month.
Mm-hmm.
So going into this is June the 23rd of 2002. There is no screwing around today. We're getting right into things.
Let's do it.
This is right into the meat of the bone.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make even sense? The marrow of the bone is what we're getting into.
The bone of the meat, maybe.
The bone of the meat would be the better term. But we're going deeper away. Okay. That's why I use marrow.
This is
a Mark Marrow level kind of show analyzing The King of the Ring. The last time they ever ventured to pay-per-view with this tournament, which I guess is where we can start with.
Oh, yeah. This was the last King of the Ring pay-per-view.
They gave up on it after this one. Hmm. Did 320,000 buys, down from 445 the year prior.
Hmm.
So they figured it's the tournament. No one cares.
And surprising as well, because there are actual stakes to this tournament, wasn't there?
Yes, the winner of this King of the Ring was going to get the SummerSlam title shot, and given the combatants, Rob Van Dam, Chris Jericho, Brock Lesnar, and Test, there were three contenders, and realistically,
two.
I think most could
probably one.
You know, one, but you have to remember as well in June, like Brock Lesnar was every shade of green. He had only been on the main roster for 3 months at this point.
Mm-hmm.
He had come up the night after WrestleMania. And, I mean, even as we saw here, this was a far cry from the Brock Lesnar of even 6 months later.
Yeah.
Where this guy had a rapid ascension in the ring. Mm-hmm. But in June, if you wanted to break this guy down and say he's not ready, he can't do this, he can't do that, you would have a hell of an argument.
Sure.
But they didn't go with that. They said, no, we're making a star. And he became the focal point of this particular King of the Ring. But were you always a fan of these pay-per-views, these one-night tournaments?
I think so. I mean, I think they're a good break away from your typical pay-per-view, with, especially now these days with so many pay-per-views. I feel like they should bring it back more than ever. And, you know, it really, again, often depends on follow-up. I mean, there are certain years where guys won and really amounted to nothing, unfortunately. But
yeah, and then they were erased from video packages in the future when they were going over King of the Ring winners. We just skipped a couple years in this opening video.
But I love tournaments.
Well, maybe it'll come back at some point because God knows we have enough shows now in a given year for the company. Because that pay-per-view schedule that has been released, it shows the split brand pay-per-views for the rest of this year. Yeah. But we don't know what the schedule will be like next year for the first half of the year where they're going to double up on shows. So but who knows? Maybe the King of the Ring finds its way back.
Well, I mean, they've actually had Kings of the Ring. Yeah, but again, they've all really amounted to nothing.
Sheamus.
Yeah. Can you name the last three? Wade Barrett. Sheamus.
Sheamus was 2010. Regal won it before that.
Was there anyone before that?
Probably in between there were some kings.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
last year's was awful. Last year's was just
terrible. That was Wade Barrett?
That was there where basically it was announced on Monday and it concluded the next night, I think.
Yeah.
Or a week later.
Mm.
Very weak. So the show starts off and I guess it's worth noting here that this was just a few weeks after the infamous Steve Austin walkout, where Austin had been scheduled to be in a King of the Ring qualifying match against Brock Lesnar.
Really? That was a King of the Ring qualifying?
That was going to be a King of the Ring qualifying match.
He was supposed to lose.
There was going to be, it appeared afterwards that there would be some kind of interference because Austin had started a feud with Eddie Guerrero, and that was going to be the match on this pay-per-view. It would be Austin against Eddie and Chris Benoit as well assisting Eddie Guerrero. So it appeared that Brock would beat Austin likely through the help of Eddie and maybe Benoit, and Austin thought, and I don't disagree with him, thought this is the last match on Brock's rise to the top, not the first. This could be a major match a few months from now, and we were going to put it on unadvertised on Raw on a Monday night, and this was a few weeks after Austin had been very vocal on an episode of Bite This about the creative direction of the WWE, which it was pretty awful at this point. Business was down a year over year. Austin had seen the heights they had risen to through him and others, and now business was going down, and so there was a lot of frustration. And then he got to the arena, and with the plan laid out, he got up and he took off.
Yeah.
And we got the infamous, he took his ball and went home.
Just grabbed,
analogy.
Yeah.
What a child.
That basketball that he would lend to the roster every week, just took it, went home.
Which when you're done, and you own the ball, and there were $456 million of reasons why he did own the ball at the time, you do take it home with you. And of course, then The Rock came back the following week as a surprise where the WWE, they were like, let's build a whole show around the idea that he is returning.
He brought his ball.
He
brought a replacement
well,
ball.
He used the line. So Steve took his ball and went home. But for The Rock, this is home. What cheesy line.
He went home. Oh, okay, so The Rock.
He's saying Austin took his ball and went home, but for The Rock, here is home. And then it got more serious because then there was a domestic issue involving Steve Austin and Deborah, where Deborah had called 911. The police came, and he was not there. He had taken off, and charges were never pressed, and it didn't go any further than that. But this was certainly a lot going on with Steve Austin at the time, and probably a good idea. He was not on the roster at this point and wouldn't come back until the following year in February.
Any ideas what the ultimate plans were for him beyond the Eddie Guerrero feud?
It appeared that it was going to go from Eddie and then probably into a Benoit program. So when you look at that SummerSlam card, which that 2002 show is regarded as one of the best WWE pay-per-views of all time, you had Austin and either Eddie or Benoit as his opponent, I think would have been his plan for SummerSlam. And as well, as I was going back and reading about this time, that Shawn Michaels return, it was originally the idea was Hunter and Nash, and then Nash tore his quad. So wow. I think it was Nash's injury that led to
Sean coming back early, or Sean coming back.
Well, that
back
was
at
probably
all?
When the idea was proposed to Michaels. He was back on television at this point, but
wasn't planning on wrestling.
Well, at least not Hunter at SummerSlam.
Wow!
So
incredible.
Can you imagine that card if it had worked out where you had Austin, Rock, Shawn Michaels return, the coronation of Brock Lesnar,
mm-hmm.
and the undercard you had at this point? I mean, it would have been an even bigger show than it turned out to be.
Conversely, if it was Kevin Nash and Triple H,
I don't know if it would have been remembered as well. And we got to see that feud the following year.
Yeah. I don't know.
Doesn't exactly bring back the same memories, does it? Mm. But this was, so this is important to, because this is a very weird show, because it's Austin's gone, and I think people are accepting that, unlike where he did walk out the night after WrestleMania, but he returned shortly thereafter, 2 weeks later, this one felt more permanent. Like, this guy's gone, and now it's a summer of rebuilding and having to get new stars ready during the brand split, which wasn't lighting either brand on fire at this point.
No, this was during the time when the champion was able to travel between both shows, and The Undertaker was the champion, having won it off of Hulk Hogan.
We had gone from Jericho to Hunter to Hogan to Undertaker in the span since WrestleMania.
Mm-hmm.
They had flipped this title like it was the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag Titles way.
Wow.
Flipping it at a rapid rate. And it would flip again the following month, and the month after that, too, with Brock.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the show starts off with a video of the history of the King of the Ring. And I'm not the greatest with chronology way, but...
Sure you are. What are you talking about? You are the greatest. You really are.
1993, we saw Bret Hart winning. To 1994 with Owen winning. And then we skipped to 1996, and I swear there was a King of the Ring in 1995. I could have sworn that Art Donovan was there. No, he wasn't, actually. He was there in 94. But 95 was the Mabel year, which didn't make the video.
And 96?
96, we had Austin. 97, Hunter. And then we skipped to 2000. So we skipped Ken Shamrock. We skipped Badass Billy Gunn. I didn't know
he's no longer with the company. He didn't really go on to become champion. Sure.
So we skipped the 2000 with Angle and then 2001 with Edge. So that was in 2002. That was the history of the King of the Ring tournament.
Yeah.
Sans Mabel, Billy Gunn, and Ken Shamrock.
Forget the other ones. Yeah.
I guess they're failures that they were viewed as. And we had a big set with the King's throne at the entrance. This almost like electric chair.
The
motif.
Electric chair throne, which they didn't ever, it was just the set. It was like a giant size, like a Godzilla size throne.
Did you also pay attention to the graphical elements for the King of the Ring, where it was like these pipes bursting with water coming out of them?
Oh, that I didn't notice.
It was like, it was like the end of these pipes and water
bursting?
Was just coming through.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, very, very strange theme to this King of the Ring. Maybe it was a overall thematic of the WWE state at the time. It's it's darkest before it is bright.
This actual tournament, it took place between Raw and SmackDown, of course. Right?
Yeah, we had Raw and SmackDown. I actually have the original brackets here, Way, if you want to hear how we got to the final four.
Yeah.
This was contested over many weeks without Steve Austin in the opening round. We had Goldust against X-Pac, RVD against Eddie Guerrero, Valboski. He was not Val Venus at this point. He was Valboski, or Big Valboski, against Christian. Edge against Jericho in the opening round, and then Edge got hurt. He injured his shoulder and was hurt at this time. Hurricane against Test, Hardcore Holly against Tajiri, Booker T against William Regal, and Brock Lesnar against his late replacement, Bubba.
Okay.
That was our 2002 field.
Yeah.
Tough to, and then Brock would beat Booker. Test would beat Hardcore Holly, Jericho beat Valboski, and RVD beat X-Pac to qualify for the final four. And
gotcha.
Our final two matches are on tonight's pay-per-view.
And so who's representing Raw, who's representing SmackDown?
We had Jericho and Test from SmackDown, and Van Damme and Lesnar from Raw.
Right. Got it.
And Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler are on commentary, and we did get appearances from Michael Cole and Taz, who were given seats up in the skybox, but this was a Raw commentated show.
Yeah, I suppose this was before they even figured out, you know, hey, before they alternated commentary teams for the Raw and SmackDown matches, or was this whole show just decided to be?
No, they had started out where they were not bouncing back and forth, yeah. As I can recall. I don't think that started until the following pay-per-view, because also the GM situation was all messed up at this point, because when Austin walked out, they were in such a panic that night, they went out on Raw, and Vince just announced that because Flair was the owner of Raw and Vince was the owner of SmackDown, mm-hmm. and Vince came out on Raw and said, the ownership of the company is up for grabs tonight. I'm taking on Ric Flair on 2 hours' notice. And Vince beat him with Brock's help. And now Vince controlled both shows. And this was before we had GM. So Ric Flair was now just a wrestler.
And what did that have to do with Austin?
They just felt they needed to do something big.
Okay.
That's how they worked at the time. Okay. A crazy knee-jerk reaction to something. Not even, Flair, you will face me in 2 weeks at the pay-per-view for ownership of the company. No, we're going to do it tonight.
So wait, so that whole ownership thing was after the brand split?
Yeah, because the draft was set up where Flair controlled Raw,
right.
And Vince only had SmackDown.
Gotcha, right,
and
right.
So this was the interim period before they brought in Eric Bischoff and Stephanie McMahon to be the GMs of each show.
Gotcha.
So there we start off with Chris Jericho and Rob Van Dam in the semifinals of the tournament. And Van Dam is the Intercontinental Champion at this point. Both start off. RVD does his thumb pose and Jericho slaps him. Jericho comes off the turnbuckle, misses Van Dam on the apron, and Van Dam delivers a Tope Con Hero to the floor. Van Dam then goes for a frog splash in the ring, and Jericho kicks the referee into the ropes as Van Dam gets crotched. There's a double underhook superplex by Jericho from the top. Jericho then takes off the turnbuckle pad, and Van Dam uses an inside cradle, but the referee is busy putting the padding onto the turnbuckle and only counts two. There are chants for Chris Jericho that Jerry Lawler picks up on and acknowledges. Jericho hit a release German, and Van Dam just stayed folded over onto his neck. Van Dam was very good at taking suplexes and landing on his back and neck and making it look like this man's spine had just been adjusted.
Yeah, he's got a reputation. I mean, people call him, Taz would always call him Gumby, and he's got a reputation for just being incredibly, incredibly flexible.
There's a great callback to WrestleMania where Jericho got slingshot into the corner, and Jericho landed on the ropes and then jumped back into a kick by Van Dam, and that's how Hunter caught him with the pedigree at WrestleMania, but no one noted that here. There was a lion salt. Van Dam got out of the way. Jericho landed on his feet, and then Van Dam hit a jumping kick, then missed a frog splash. Jericho hit a lion salt, got a two count. Hurricane Rana was blocked into the walls, but they were near the corner for a rope break, and then it came down to Jericho getting kicked by RVD, and he slipped on the top, crotching himself as Van Dam recovered and hit the frog splash. They went 14 minutes and 33 seconds, and this is a very controversial matchway, which I will explain later. But what were your thoughts on the opener?
I thought it was a really good match. I thought they planned a lot of really intricate things here, and I thought they both nailed pretty much everything. And, you know, I thought here we got to see both men in great shape. RVD arguably still a part of his prime at this point. And Jericho, I mean, I don't know if you could really say he was in his prime at the time, because I think he's almost just as good today. It's incredible the shape that he's in. But I think both guys were very athletic and agile here. And Jericho in particular, I think, really led RVD into a really good RVD match.
This match, I agree. I watched this back, and I thought this was one of, if not the best match on the show. I thought this was great because at the time, this match got a lot of criticism and people complained about it to the point that Chris Jericho wrote a commentary on his website and basically wrote that he thought it was a great match and he was very upset that people had a negative view on this match. And I can't remember. I couldn't find this commentary, but I remember it very clearly.
Why do people think it was bad?
I don't know if it was just maybe that they... I don't know, because watching back, I thought this was a great match. I thought this was a great opener. And they got a lot of time, and there's RVD matches where he'll do a lot of spectacular stuff, but he's missing as much as he's hitting. That was not the case in this match.
Yeah, I wonder what the criticism could have been, because I couldn't really pick it up. Were people expecting more high-flying, perhaps?
Like, the crowd wasn't super hot.
Yeah.
I mean, there's little things you could nitpick,
But that's not their fault. It's not the performer's fault, I don't think.
I can't really find a ton to criticize about this, but yeah. Jericho was so upset that he wrote in this commentary that he was going to contemplate dedicating less time to his website because of people's critique of this match.
Could you imagine? I mean, it's hard for me to even remember a time before Twitter where people would be able to write at length their thoughts on a situation rather than, you know, a couple tweets.
How much more civil would wrestling and the world be, Way, if instead of tweets – you wrote lengthy commentaries.
Blog entries.
That's where, like, what was it called? The My Journal? Live Journal.
Yeah.
That's what needs to make a comeback.
Did you ever have one of those?
I didn't have a Live Journal.
No.
You?
I had something like it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I was rocking GeoCities, Way. I was busy crafting. Actually, no, in 2002, I did not have an outlet.
No. MySpace?
This was post-Jaws.
Did you ever get into MySpace?
I did have a MySpace. No, not my own. We made a law one.
Made a law one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only MySpace I have.
Uh-huh. All right.
So anyway, I thought a really great match.
Yeah, I did too.
With Rob Van Dam winning, rather, to go to the finals. And then Jerry Lawler came into the ring playing Joe Rogan to interview Rob Van Dam. And he's going to face the winner of Lesnar and Test. And he says, any preference, Rob? And Van Dam says, whatever. Whatever.
I hated this RVD. I really hated these types of promos he would cut.
And
I'm sure he hated them too. They're just so simple and way too, he's surfer. He's a surfer.
He said it was fine if it's Godzilla that he faces in the finals. Yeah. But Godzilla did not qualify for the semifinals, so that's ridiculous.
It's Godzilla, dude.
Bro, what can I do? And then he gets attacked from behind by newly minted babyface Chris Jericho, if anyone was listening to this interview, and hit a sling blade style maneuver that he was using at the time where he wouldn't rotate around, but he would wrap his arms around and drop the guy back first. So a blade without the sling.
Gotcha.
And leaves them there, puts them in the walls, and they have to be separated by officials.
Yeah, Jericho was trying a couple new moves at the time. He had that. He was using the stroke for a while.
He's doing that. He was also, this was the dyeing the tips of his ponytail red phase.
Right.
He was throwing a lot at the wall at the time.
Sure.
Very Vince Russo-esque, which is our other major story going on at the time.
What do you mean?
Well, there was a sign in the crowd, Way, you may have seen here. That said, fire Russo, hire me, because on the Thursday before this King of the Ring, out of fucking nowhere, the WWE announced on their website that they had hired back Vince Russo.
Right, yes.
And Vince Russo's tenure during his second run with the company lasted 24 hours because after a meeting with the creative team, it apparently did not go well because after being brought in and assumed he would be the head writer, he was then told, maybe you could be a consultant. And he did not become a consultant. And within weeks, he was officially with TNA Wrestling.
Yeah, right.
This was the ultimate panic move, in my opinion, during a time when they didn't know what to do. And this was when Stephanie was heading creative. Mm-hmm. And to go back to the well with Vince Russo, this to me screamed panic. This whole month screamed panic,
Also, I mean, when Vince Russo was originally around, he was a part of a two-man team with Ed Ferrara. Now he's walking into a completely different dynamic with a bunch of different writers.
Well, yeah, and the stories from the time was that when he met with the writers, you know, he threw out all these ideas, and it became apparent that he was not watching weekly. It wasn't up on all the characters that were currently on screen, which in the grand scheme of things, do I think that a writer could come in not watching weekly and still be effective? Yes, but that probably did not do him any favors.
Politically.
Exactly. Yeah. And this was a guy that probably had a lengthy list of enemies from when he left the company and a pretty sour reputation from WCW at this point in time. But what a difference the WWE may have been with a year of Vince Russo writing that 2002 product. Hmm. So he was not hired back. Paul Heyman and Brock Lesnar are in the locker room and basically make fun of Rob Van Dam's promo and calling him Godzilla. And they're going to prove who is fake and who is real. and that Brock is the next big thing, and he will be the next King of the Ring. A very different Paul Heyman from today versus then. I mean, this was a much more over-the-top Paul Heyman, where I feel the version now is just a bit...
I like the version now better.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah.
This was still a lot of elements of Paulie Dangerously in him.
And I think he was still very good. I mean, I suppose you could say he played more of a traditional, you know, heel manager at the time, but I thought...
Agent way. He was an agent. Okay, so, and now an advocate.
But I think still very effective. And I just feel like the pairing of these two is one of the all-time classic manager-wrestler pairings, because here you have one of the best talkers in the business ever in Paul Heyman. Now giving a voice to this monster of a man, Brock Lesnar, and you essentially, on the other hand, you give Paul Heyman this incredible physique of Brock Lesnar. So the two of them really combine to make one single great pairing. I would hate to see the opposite, though. Like maybe somebody with the body of Paul Heyman and the voice of Brock Lesnar. Like, you know the movie Twins?
Yes.
Remember how like one twin got the best chromosomes, and the other twin got like the worst. So I'd hate to see if these two were in the womb together, what would result on the other end.
That's quite the visual to imagine. That is not reality.
Yeah.
So, I just imagine that had the WWF had such a hang up about managers at this point in time, could you have imagined bringing Brock up to the roster without a mouthpiece?
Even during his second run.
Oh,
when they were initially
originally had John Laurinaitis speaking for him.
Oh my God!
Like, go back and watch those first few Raws after his comeback in 2012. Before, because Heyman didn't come back for at least a month. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was an emergency call. Listen, we have sunk all this money into him, but back at this point, it was kind of the same circumstance. They had signed him to a ridiculously high developmental deal, and this was not someone that we could just treat like a Luther Reigns or a Nathan Jones. I mean, they had a lot invested in this guy, and it led to Heyman's return to television, and a wise one at the time, because now Heyman was also starting to oversee SmackDown by this point, going into the summer. Test against Brock Lesnar was our semifinal match, and there were shoulder blocks into the corner by Lesnar. Very limited range of offense from Brock Lesnar this early in his main roster tenure, and something that was following him at this time were Goldberg chants, which he would grow out of, but that was certainly prevalent at this point in time. Lesnar avoids a big boot and bails to the floor, regrouping with Heyman, and then Lesnar comes back with stomps, hits a power slam, and Jim Ross breaking down Brock Lesnar, which how appropriate is this in 2016, stating, "Lesnar is a highly skilled, highly trained grappler, not a striker." Boy.
Yeah, I know.
I hope Mark Hunt was not watching The King of the Ring 2002 and taking notes. Mm. There was a full Nelson slam by Test, who then made a comeback, goes for a pump handle slam, and that was blocked by Lesnar, who then goes for it again, gets a two count. Lesnar ducks a running boot. The powerbomb gets blocked by Test, and he hits this big boot, and Lesnar kicks out, and this crowd went nuts here. They bought that Test was going to beat Brock Lesnar and go to the finals. In terms of the goal of this match, it was accomplished with that near fall. Test then goes for another, but Heyman gets onto the apron to distract, and it allows Lesnar to hit the newly named F5 to pin Test in 8 minutes and 18 seconds, and leads to a all-Raw final for the King of the Ring crown. And this match was way better than I remember it being. Yeah. And Test doesn't get a ton of credit, but there were certain guys, Edge he had very good chemistry with. This match, too, was... I mean, Test was the one who kind of had to lead this one.
Yeah, it definitely exceeded expectations, and I thought they got a great pop for that big boot near fall. You know, Brock, for perhaps as limited as he was at the time compared to what we see today, I thought none of his stuff ever really looked sloppy. I thought he always had a really good intensity in his moves, and perhaps it's just something that comes natural to him, something that he can't necessarily help but have his moves look like they really hurt. So, you know, I thought he, for somebody so relatively inexperienced, I thought he seemed to take to wrestling pretty well early on.
Yes, this was my surprise match on the show, having not watched this in 14 years. Had you watched this show before?
I think so. It's been 14 years.
Because the company was coming down in popularity, so that typically is your jump on point
yeah,
if you
much.
Look at Wei Ting's history of WWE viewing. Jonathan Coachman is backstage, and he goes into the Raw locker room to get predictions for tonight's final. Bubba, who has been feuding with Lesnar on TV, is picking Lesnar and wishes it was him, but he's going to bounce back. This was a total MMA interview from Bubba Ray Dudley.
It was your babyface Bubba Ray Dudley before he really stumbled onto any sort of compelling character, I'd say.
And was probably still in a better role than he is today.
Maybe.
This guy's losing on kickoff shows to the Lucha Dragons.
Yeah, but I'll also say that he's at the point now where he can kind of afford these losses. And, you know, he's not there to be world champion. Anyway, whatever.
He better get better utilized after this draft. He is a necessary guy. They're talking about going back and bringing back all these names.
Yeah. I don't think they will, though. I think Vince sees him as, you know, just the tag team guy. I don't think he's aware of the great heel run that he had in TNA.
Well, someone's got to sit down, Vince, and watch, you know, some
Aces and Eights,
some Bound for Glory buildup in 2013. Do you remember, Way, the SmackDown backstage interviewer at the time? Do you remember his name?
I do now because I looked it up after the show, but at the time, while watching this, I was like, wow, I remember that face. I don't know that dude's name, though. I haven't thought about this dude in 14 years.
If you were to put in first and last names and just put the most generic names into both hats, and you just pick two out of the first name category, you might pick Mark and Lloyd and put them together, and we have our backstage interviewer, one of the more forgotten backstage interviewers.
Mark, M-A-R-C.
M-A-R-C, very exotic. Yeah. He was outside the SmackDown locker room, and out came Lance Storm and Christian, all dressed, I don't know for what. And Storm's pissed that it is not an all-Canadian final with Jericho and Test. Christian calls the WWE prejudice against Canadians, and the entire country hates Canada, but the entire world hates America. And Storm doesn't want to fall into their hateful abyss, and this is planting the seeds that would grow into the Un-Americans, which originally they had the idea of Jericho being a part of, and Jericho would end up going to Raw.
Thank goodness he missed that one.
Yes. Yeah. And Jericho was very vocal, too, when he got traded from SmackDown to Raw. And I can't remember the comparison at the point, but he did this interview, and he was like, they're like, what's it like going from SmackDown to Raw? He's like, it's like being traded from the Detroit Red Wings to the Columbus Blue Jackets. He was not happy about his move to Raw because SmackDown was the worker show at the point.
These guys ended up on Raw too.
They ended up on Raw. This was all like Benoit was drafted to SmackDown,
yep.
And then he returned on Raw.
There were a lot of growing pains during that first few months of that brand split. All things that I'm hoping that they learn from this time around. But I'm expecting similar situations where they'll probably draft guys to one show and realize, hey, you know what? He fits better here. Let's just bring him back here. Anyway, Mark Lloyd, pretty much if you're writing like a job opening out there looking for goofy looking, nerdy reporters, they found the perfect guy. This was the top candidate.
Well, Mark Lloyd, who had a cup of coffee with the company, was here all over King of the Ring. Then we go into the skybox for the SmackDown announce crew, Michael Cole and Tazza, and they tee up the Cruiserweight title match coming up with Jamie Noble and his, quote, freak of a girlfriend, Nydia. And the storyline is that Nydia used to date the Hurricane but got dumped, and she is now a vengeful witch, according to Cole, and says, it started with Nydia playing the role of the stalker, and it all started with the letters. As we went into the most in-depth video package for a Cruiserweight title match in WWE history, I would go so far as to say. This was a time when the Cruiserweights were not having to do legit weigh-ins and having a sports-like presentation as they do in 2016.
Oh, you mean in the Cruiserweight tournament they're not doing girlfriend angles with letters? And
I watched this right around the time I watched the introductions of the Cruiserweights and I could not help but imagine Mauro Ranallo and Daniel Bryan having to tee up the letters.
God.
It all started with the letters with that vengeful witch. Nydia revealed herself after these anonymous letters were sent to the Hurricane in the locker room and then was sneak attacked by Jamie Noble. And Nydia...
In his debut.
Yes, in his debut. And Nydia, who's apparently a sex addict, gets turned on by confrontation. This also included Nydia stealing the Hurricane's mask and then wearing them as panties, removing them in the ring to put on Jamie Noble's face. Mm-hmm. For, I guess, some bondage play that they were incorporating into this.
Yeah.
And that sets up our big match, which was the renewal of Three Count and the Young Dragons.
That's right.
Yes, with
continuation.
Two distinct members.
But obviously, at this point, completely negating that whole history. And I think, to me, the standout of this entire thing was the reappearance of Nydia coming off of Tough Enough, somebody who I really had very low hopes for as the runner-up of Tough Enough that season to Maven. But coming out here as a completely reinvented character as this trailer park trash witch.
Vengeful witch.
Vengeful witch, yes.
So Nydia comes out wearing the Hurricane's cape, and the match starts off. Hurricane hit a Shining Wizard early on and then went for a chokeslam, and Noble stopped him with back elbows. The crowd then started chanting, "She's a crack whore," towards Nydia as the Divas Revolution was in its embryonic stages in Columbus, Ohio, I guess. Lawler jokes about Jim Ross wanting to have a shower with Nydia. And Ross says, "That woman is young enough to be my daughter." And Lawler says, "That isn't a bad thing." And Ross adds that it's a different ball game when it's coming from Jerry Lawler about mm-hmm. the age of a particular individual. Noble runs him into the corner. There's an electric chair to the Hurricane. Crowd was not that into this at the start. They seem more interested in Nydia.
Crowd seems subdued for, I'd say, the beginning of a lot of these matches.
Well, there were a lot of issues with this particular setup for a cruiserweight match. There was an abdominal stretch by Noble, then a jawbreaker to break a sleeper. Hurricane grabbed his cape, but then Nydia stole it back, and then a vertical suplex sent Noble to the floor, and Hurricane followed with a high cross down to the floor. Nydia distracts Hurricane by making out with him, and this led to Noble hitting Hurricane with a baseball slide dropkick. They fought onto the top turnbuckle. Hurricane hit a spinning neckbreaker from the top and then climbed up, but Nydia distracted the referee. Hurricane then sidestepped, and Noble knocked Nydia off the apron, turned around into a choke slam, which Hurricane got a near fall off of, and the crowd responded to that. And then Noble knocked Hurricane off the top, hit a powerbomb, and Nydia then knocked Hurricane's foot off the bottom rope. Did she do it better than Dana Brooke?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. So much.
This
better.
Is a pro. Dana needs to be watching her Nydia videos.
Uh-huh.
And Noble gets the pinfall. 11 minutes, 58 seconds, and then Nydia jumps onto Jamie Noble to celebrate.
Yeah. I thought the match was good, but, it was the lack of crowd reaction that kind of made it seem kind of uneventful. But
they also had to work the same style as the heavyweights. That was a big criticism of the WWE's cruiserweight division was, we don't want you doing all your high-flying and,
right.
For lack of a better term, the WCW style. Mm-hmm. And this is what you got, Pick a body part and work as if you're heavyweights.
Yeah, and thus the match itself didn't really seem like it stood out all that much. To also do a title change, it's sort of a quick fashion, I'm never really a fan of. It didn't really seem all that important to me, but I understood that was, sort of the storyline they wanted to go with. But here, to have JR and Lawler call the match was a little jarring to me too, because the cruiserweights are on SmackDown, so you would have Cole and Taz call all their matches, but on the pay-per-view you heard JR and Lawler call them. So there's a bit of a problem there for me.
I could envision that Jerry Lawler did not watch an episode of SmackDown leading into this pay-per-view, and all he needed was that video package and Nydia's involvement, and he was good to go.
Oh, she's hot.
Oh, yeah. Got it.
Yeah.
The Rock arrives at the building on Sunday Night Heat. Why? Because he has something, quote, on his mind. And this is how Raw ended on the Monday when he returned. He returned and said that he was coming back early and he would be at the King of the Ring. So he has arrived.
Do you know what movie he would have been filming?
He wasn't filming anything at this point. He was going to be doing that he was going to be doing a movie in September after a SummerSlam. I think it was El Dorado, which then got a name change that he was doing. But he was supposed to be coming back like 2 weeks later, and he ended up coming back a bit earlier with the Austin stuff. Terry is our another backstage interviewer at the time, less generic than Mark Lloyd.
The Raw backstage interviewer.
And she is with Eddie Guerrero. And this was when Eddie Guerrero, I think, was just on fire. Mm-hmm. You really could see this guy breaking through. And they show highlights of Raw where Chris Benoit confronted Ric Flair. And the story was that they were blaming Ric Flair for chasing Austin off, costing Eddie the biggest program of his career, and Benoit losing a year of his career, somehow tying that to Ric Flair as well.
Yeah, just blaming Ric Flair.
Yeah, so he says here how Flair had ruined his life and Austin leaving. They attacked Flair on Raw, and there was a figure four applied to Ric Flair. So Flair was taking Austin's spot at the King of the Ring. And Guerrero does this promo saying hello to all of his brothers, his cousins, including Chewy and Juanita, as well as little Timmy, the little foster kid they picked up over the weekend.
Come on, Mamacita. First of all right? Let's stay. Wait. I'd like to take this opportunity, okay, to say hello to my brothers. Órale, Chavo, Mando, Hector. Ese, ¿qué pasó, carnales, man? What's up, man? It's me. That's right. Oh, man, I can't forget, man. My abuelita, you know? Hey, ¿qué pasó, abuelita? Oh, wait. My cousins, that's right. Chuy, Beto, Tavo, Juanito, Juanita, Maria. Yeah, hello. There's a lot more, but I can't get through them, you know? It's all right. Hola, ¿qué pasó? Hey, you know what? I almost forgot. Little Timmy. Yeah, man, he's that foster kid we picked up over the weekend. Yeah. Órale, Simón. Oye, ¿sabes qué? You know, they're at the Chantón right now, man. Yeah, they're all checking me out, man. They're checking me out, man, because I'm going to take on, you know, woo! The Nature Boy, Ric Flair, órale, the legend, la leyenda. And you're asking me, mommy, if I'm worried. Estás loca. Are you crazy? Ha! Estoy en la mejor condición de mi vida. I'm in the best shape of my life. I'm in my prime, baby. Ha! Ric Flair, he can't do half the moves I do in the ring. I mean, he only dreams about that. Lo sueña. You know what I mean, baby? You know, he says he has one last great run left. You know, man, the only running he's gonna do is the running to the retirement home, baby. And the only memory he's gonna have left when it's all over is the one of the vato, the man who put him there. Latino. Heat.
And then turns into this angry promo on Flair, states he's in the best shape of his life, he's in his prime, and Flair can't do half the moves that I can, and Flair has one last run, and that is running to the retirement home. I thought this was an excellent promo from Eddie Guerrero.
This run of Eddie's, like coming back around like 2002, is like one of my favorite runs of his, leading into the SmackDown 6, and I mean... just him with the mullet, playing a heel. I really wish that Austin program, you know, somehow went through, because I would have loved to have seen that. But, you know, he's one of my favorite wrestlers. I choose to remember him fondly. But you can't watch a show like this without looking at dude's physique and how how crazy it was. Him, Benoit, and Flair on this show.
Dude, a lot of guys on this. 2002 was an era of excess.
Yeah, and I just, like, you see a body like that, and knowing, you know, how the guy ultimately died, it's like...
You can't separate the two.
No, you can't. It's so... Anyway. But, again, you know, these are the pressures these guys are expected to you know, live up to if they want to make it to the main event, right?
Yeah, and you look up and down in this roster, and that's where I've always looked at it, and people will say, well, it's pro wrestling. It's not like we're dealing with, you know, it gives you a competitive advantage. It's your own personal decision. And to that, I would say, if you are a clean guy sitting in that locker room and you're an underneath person and you're seeing the kind of guys that are getting pushed, that are getting way more television time for you. Is it really an independent choice to get on this or not? Or is it an implied message? It doesn't have to be spoken, but listen, I look like this naturally and these are the physiques that are clearly in demand by this company. And that's where I feel there is a pressure if you want to be clean, at least at this time in 2002. So Ric Flair and Eddie Guerrero was our next match, and they dubbed over Flair's entrance here and used his first run theme music from 91 through 93 here to come out to.
Did they not have the rights?
I guess there was some issue with that, which was the theme he used throughout that whole time when he came back in 2001 was not used here. And Eddie comes out. There is a sign that reads "Dirtiest Mullet in the Game," and Lawler asks Ross about it and says he doesn't know of any mullets being cut off as a result of Eddie having one. And this was a direct reference to the plane ride from hell where X-Pac had cut off Michael Hayes' mullet. So a little inside reference there. This was also a rematch way from Hog Wild 1996 in front of a bunch of bikers. Guerrero woos and struts at the beginning of this. It is amazing to watch the charisma of Eddie Guerrero. Compare it to that 1996 match. I mean, this was a different performer, charisma-wise. Lawler says that Guerrero was supposed to face Austin, and let's be honest, probably would have beat Austin.
Wow.
Flair low blows Guerrero, and then Flair hits a vertical suplex, and Guerrero favors his lower back. Guerrero wraps his knee around the post and attacks the left knee, and we got the Ric Flair trademark selling of, ah, shit! Really emphasize the pressure being put on his knee. Guerrero applies a figure four, and Flair became the first man I've ever seen whose forehead started bleeding from a figure four. I mean, this guy, I think it was just scar tissue, and he had, like, cuts on his head. There was blood.
Blood vessel burst.
Man. Gets the rope break. Not a whole lot of heat in this match. They trade chops. Crowd is wooing. Then there was a back body drop that sent Guerrero to the floor. Guerrero missed a frog splash, and Flair clipped his knee and attacked it. Chris Benoit then came out in dress pants minus a shirt.
Cuz?
And, yeah, this guy looked crazy.
Yeah.
Like, this was, you know, this
like
was
an action figure.
This was just as he had come back, a year off from his neck surgery. And Flair is applying a figure four, and Guerrero reaches the rope. Flair then goes on top, and Guerrero attempts to bridge up but cannot, and then hits a tornado DDT. Flair gets his foot on the rope, and then behind the referee's back, Benoit brings Flair to the floor and applies a crossface on him. Benoit then is getting ejected when Guerrero is alone in the ring, and Bubba Ray Dudley appears and hits Eddie with a Bubba bomb and then runs through the crowd as Benoit chases him off. And then Flair crawls into the ring on top of Guerrero, and Ric Flair pins Eddie Guerrero at 17 minutes and 2 seconds. So Guerrero, A, loses his Austin program, loses to Ric Flair, and it felt like the direction here was that Eddie would be set up with Bubba in 2002. So things did not look bright on this particular night for Eddie Guerrero.
Was that the match he ended up having?
They didn't really go in that direction. He ended up, well, they moved to SmackDown just a few weeks later, and it kind of got Benoit and Eddie away from Raw.
Yeah, I mean, it was cool to see Flair and Eddie in a match together, but I can't say it was all that impressive of a match. I thought Flair, despite, you know, obviously being in great shape here, I thought was still quite limited in terms of mobility at the time.
At your own risk, buddy.
At your own risk. F-A-M-O-U-S. And especially against Eddie, you know, who just, in all of his matches, moved so fast. To see him having to kind of work at Ric Flair's rate, a little, you know, not really kind of. I'd like to go back to watch that 96 match.
Yeah, I thought this was a disappointment, given who was in here. Ric Flair was not all that far removed from, you know, his period where he was still able to go out and have really solid matches. I mean, they were more few and far between by this point in time, but I just thought this was not really a memorable match in any way. And I also didn't like the outcome. There was no reason Ric Flair needed to win this match. He was not going to be a pushed guy on Raw, even though I think they felt a dire situation with the top guys on Raw that Flair was one of them. But to me, this was a whole summer about rebuilding, and Eddie Guerrero would have been right near the top of my list of someone that you could see catching fire and didn't need a loss here. The one thing with Austin, it was very different with Ric Flair, who you did not have, you know, scheduled for any kind of big spot on Raw. Then we go to an ad because the WWF had recently lost the rights to those initials and we're doing the whole get the F out campaign. So we had an asshole at the bar with a WWF logo on his head hitting on these women and getting turned down. And then all the women flocked to the other guy with his WWE logo head.
I thought the WWF logo head got, like, the F got blown off and then the women started to flock towards him. Not once he got the F out.
Oh, I thought we were just cutting to another guy in the bar. I can't say my attention was completely invested in the spot.
I thought the campaign was pretty clever.
It was a very catchy slogan.
Yeah.
Get the F out. They even sold shirts that get the F out.
Yeah, imagine wearing one of those today in the streets.
Imagine wearing 95% of WWF shirts from this point in time. William Regal and Christopher Nowinski were at The World in New York waiting on their food. And the waitress shows up with their food, and Chris Nowinski, who is – he was a real great asshole here, says, where did you go to school? And she lists off a community college, and Nowinski is just so embarrassed and just laughs at her lack of education. And Regal calls her a silly tart, and she put a finger into his food before delivering it.
Is that that bad?
In 2002, with the WWE's way of thinking, this was completely tame.
Yeah.
So, there you have it. Yeah. That was their whole involvement in the night. They were flown to New York for this. 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. Trish Stratus and Molly Holly were next for the WWE Women's title. The storyline in 2002 was that Molly Holly was fat. She was so fat.
She had a big ass, and they were hinting that she was a virgin.
Yes.
What a heel. What a heel.
Oh, the worst. There was a sign in the crowd that read Molly's Thong, where this dude had this giant pair of panties on his sign. How this man walked in public is a mystery. And the fact that it now exists for everyone to see, you must be very proud, sir. You must be oh so proud.
I'm the Molly's Thong guy.
Because she's fat. Get it? And, of course, Molly's finish is the Molly go-round off the top where she lands ass first. And there's just so much of it that the person would be knocked out. A high point in WWE gender equality and their history. Very fast-paced start. Strikes from Trish. Lawler is trying to get a she's a fat ass chant going. Holly goes for a Fujiwara armbar, and there are light chants for puppies. Stratus hit a victory roll, got a two count, and then followed up with a neck breaker. Then a drop toe hold snaps Trish's neck on the bottom rope, and she gets sent to the floor and then tossed into the crowd and attacks the lower back. Back in the ring, Trish hits a handstand into a Hurricane Rana off the top, and then Trish delivers a kick to the head. The Stratus faction gets blocked, and then into a bridging German for a two count. Molly goes up top for the Molly go-round, or as Lawler calls it, the butt bomb. And then Stratus rolls her up, but it's reversed. Molly grabs her tights, and Molly pins Trish at 542, winning the title. As Jim Ross says, that this is the first time that the women's champion is virginal. Virginal. And that is not the female version of Virgil.
Virgil. Yeah. Yeah, you know, the storylines like this are really embarrassing to look back at. I'm sure, you know, even Jim Ross himself, I can't.
Lineup advertisers.
Yeah, I can't imagine, you know, being too proud of storylines like this at the, you know, in 2016. I think.
But come on, I thought the Attitude Era was awesome. I thought everything about it was the best. Why can't we go back to it?
The match itself, I thought, it was very short, it seemed, and it resulted in these two working very fast, and you could tell, you know, especially, Molly was very capable, but you could tell especially somebody like Trish was working very hard to try to change the perception of the women's wrestling at the time, and, you know, Trish, I mean, look at where she went, it came from in a year, from barking like a dog for Vince McMahon to, you know, somebody who was trying to be taken seriously as a female wrestler.
At a time where being taken seriously did not exactly correlate with the company's direction for the women's division. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was very much the work of people like Trish and Jazz and Victoria, but also Fit Finley, Lance yep. Storm, who worked with them. But this was a way where, I mean, the WWE, they allowed these women this outlet to go out there and have those kinds of matches, but they didn't get a whole ton of time mm-hmm. at that point to go out there and really have those matches. And they were constantly mixed in with other angles that were very much counter to focusing more on the wrestling element of it. Mark Lloyd's back, and he's with Kurt Angle, who was wearing his wig after having his head shaved by Edge at the prior month's pay-per-view. And Mark says that tonight is the battle of the real American heroes with Angle and Hulk Hogan, but Angle doesn't believe that Hulk Hogan is an American hero. Maybe prophetic in 2002 to be stating that. He says Vince McMahon made him an American hero. He also could have made Hogan a zookeeper. And Angle says how he won the King of the Ring 2000 and then had three matches at last year's show. And tonight he's going to make Hogan tap faster than Mr. Bojangles on speed.
What?
Exactly. Cole and Taz are in the skybox and Taz predicts a Kurt Angle victory. And then we would go into the video package. This was 14 years ago, Way, as Hogan attempted to retire on SmackDown. He said, I just wanted to bow out gracefully. But something just kept pulling him back in. And says that he will retire, but not now. And Vince McMahon was the one who stopped him. And they were actually building at one point to a Hogan and Vince match, which was another match that was rumored for SummerSlam that would not happen. And then Angle attacked Hogan, and Hogan ripped the wig off of Angle. We also got a visual for the ages. Hulk Hogan applying an ankle lock and Kurt tapping out. I mean, you can say whatever you want about Kurt Angle, but here was the guy that when he was originally given a WWF contract, said as a gold medalist, he can't lose. That ego was gone. There was not a trace of it in Kurt Angle tapping out to Hulk Hogan's ankle lock on television. Mm. Hogan as well, at this point in time, this guy was losing a ton. He lost to, first of all, he beat Triple H for the title, then lost to The Undertaker. He had lost in Triple H on television clean in the build-up to this one. And then we're going to get into this match. And then he had the Brock match in August as well. That
lost to The Rock as well.
Lost to The Rock as well at WrestleMania. But, man, you can look back at Hogan and times that he just was a guy that wouldn't lose to people. This was not that time in the spring of 02 and into the summer. I think that match with Brock was really what took Brock to the next level.
But Hogan was expecting to beat Brock.
Well, there was that understanding. But never did get that win over him. Hulk Hogan also never got to perform for ECW, but he certainly got an ECW on the WWE Network entrance because Voodoo Child is not part of the WWE's intellectual property. So Hogan came out to the worst ripoff that Jimi Hendrix would have cringed hearing with the piped-in crowd noise.
And the piped-in Howard Finkel redub.
Yes. This was awful, this entrance.
You know, for a ripoff, I can't say it was that bad. They could have found a completely different song. This was at least somebody's version of an attempt at sounding like Voodoo Child.
I would have loved if they just said, fuck it, and put Real American, but he did all the Voodoo Child like mannerisms coming out. He's like, you know, playing the guitar to Real American.
Yeah.
But this was every level like an ECW like an entrance you remember. And I watched the original online just to compare it. And it's just like, it was a mass. This guy got the biggest reaction on the show and it was murdered here on the network version.
Again, you can't really complain too much about it, you know?
No, I will weigh.
Okay.
This is a wrestling podcast. So he comes out and this is his first appearance at the King of the Ring since 1993 when he lost to Yokozuna. So not a very historically positive event for one Hogan. Taking on Kurt Angle, wearing that fucking wig.
I love that gimmick.
Oh, I hate
it. I love it. Come on, it's hilarious.
There was a novelty to it, but I didn't like it on Kirk, who I thought I was so past the comedy with Kurt at this point. I just didn't need it. But we were in the end stages of the wig phase. There were huge chants for Hogan. Would you go so far as to say he was the most over guy on this show?
I mean, The Rock, certainly.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Hunter was up there, too.
Yeah.
But I thought Hogan – I felt like this crowd had not been all that hot. They loved this match, mm-hmm. and they loved Hogan. And yep. it's not like these guys did a super taxing match, anything overly ambitious, but everything they did got so much of a bigger reaction, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
They're just going nuts off a collar and elbow tie-up where he knocks down Kurt Angle. And Angle gets sent to the floor from a shoulder block. Ross is making fun of Kurt Angle hiding his baldness, wearing, quote, that hideous thing on his head as Hogan's working this match with a bandana on. I mean, one, it's chosen baldness, or at least hair that could probably grow back. Anyway, the bandana gets knocked off around 3 minutes into the match. Hogan could just do no wrong to this crowd as they chanted for him. They were fully into the nostalgia of Hogan. Mm-hmm. And I thought that when they put the title on him, it was one of those, okay, this is one step too much.
Yeah.
And let's dial it back. People wanted to see Hogan in limited doses, but not as champion.
Yeah, I agree. I think for as much as I mean, I was there. We were both there for WrestleMania 18 when he did the Hulk up and everything, and I think we all loved it.
That crowd was like alcohol.
Yep.
And the crowd and the company got drunk off that night. And the next night in Montreal too, yep. where they gave him that crazy reaction.
Yeah, but even you and I and anybody watching could see that this man was clearly very limited in the ring, especially compared to younger guys like The Rock, like Kurt Angle here, you know, that to the point where it was just not believable.
You couldn't buy this guy going 50-50 with Triple H the next month. Yeah. I mean, even watching this, I mean, he's going with Kurt Angle here, which is a testament to Kurt, but it's like, it was a real tough visual to get over, but there was so much nostalgia behind Hulk Hogan at this point in 2002 and being back in a WWF environment. There were 9 headshots into the turnbuckle, and then he finished with a punch to Kurt Angle. Just 101 shit here from Hogan that all was working. Angle knocked him with a low blow and then back suplexed Hogan, then hit him with a second back suplex. Angle applied a sleeper. The crowd's rallying behind Hogan as his arm stays up on the third try. He gets to his feet. He puts Angle in a sleeper, and Angle suplexes out of that. Angle hit an angle slam as Hogan's back was probably needing many surgeries at this point. And Hogan kicks out of the angle slam for a big pop. And then he starts to Hulk up as the crowd goes nuts. Hits a big boot, takes off Angle's wig, and Angle retreats to the floor. He goes to leave as Hogan puts on Kurt's wig, and this outrages Kurt. He says, no, I can't leave while he's wearing my wig. So Angle gets a chair and runs in and does the Kurt Angle spot, missing Hogan, and the chair bounces off the top rope and knocks him in the head.
That's got to be really tough because he got hit with the bad end of the chair too, not even the flat side.
Oh, he loved this spot. Oh, Kurt did this so much and then gets drilled with a Hogan big boot, but then Hogan misses the leg drop and Angle applies an ankle lock. He pulls him into the middle. Hogan is trying to turn onto his back and kick him away, but Angle won't let go. Pulls him back, and finally, Hulk Hogan taps out at 12 minutes and 9 seconds, one of the rare submission losses for Hogan, especially as a babyface. Like, I can recall, you know, WCW to Piper and to Luger, probably Sting in there as well, but as a babyface, I mean, this was a clean loss, and it was the right finish, and this crowd, for many ways, I put this as the match of the night. It wasn't as good technically as Van Damme and Jericho, I thought, but this crowd loved this, and I thought this was just – it was perfect for what it needed to be.
Absolutely. I think if you're going to, you know, put on the marquee Kurt Angle versus Hulk Hogan in 2012, I think this is probably the best you would be able to expect. It was certainly a more slower and limited match than we've seen with Kurt based off of Hogan's limitations, but certainly a way above average Hulk Hogan match by this point. And, you know, I thought the match was very good. The end result was positive. In particular, I really enjoyed Kurt's use of the ankle lock at the time and how he had developed sort of a tug-of-war routine with the ankle lock, how he would have his opponents reach the rope, Angle would pull it back, would ground it, would just do all these variations to really make that submission seem much more exciting than a simple quick tap out. So I love seeing Kurt Angle here. And JR calling it added a lot too. This was, I guess, a case where SmackDown
yes.
match, right? Where I guess what it really benefited from JR's call.
And then to close out the crazy month of June, it was on the SmackDown coming out of the King of the Ring that Kurt came out and he announced he's no longer embarrassed by his baldness and ditched the wig and made an open challenge, which was answered by John Cena. It was John Cena's main roster debut. Mm-hmm. And could you imagine if all those clips we've seen of Cena's debut featured the wig and he had just tossed it aside earlier in the promo. But crazy month of June 2002 in WWE history when you look at everything that happened in that month. Booker T and Goldust are backstage. This was when the NWO angle had been going on where Booker had been kicked out of the group and you had the less memorable version of Kevin Nash, Shawn Michaels, X-Pac, and Big Show populating the NWO, which was just awful television at that time, I thought.
To this day, to see, like on this show later on, to see Shawn Michaels in an NWO shirt is just so wrong.
And that haircut.
Just makes no sense.
His hair was just awful at this point, too. Mm. Had like the little, you know.
The short.
Yeah, less than shoulder length.
Yeah.
Booker T is with Goldust. Goldust is dressed up as The Rock and does an impression of The Rock, who walks up from behind him. Rock does his routine. Booker T goes through his own. Booker says that the two of them have never seen eye to eye, but he is down with what The Rock said last week, where Rock had come out and given kind of a rallying the troops speech, saying, if you don't want to be here, then as the slogan says, get the F out. And they are here to watch the Undisputed title match. Goldust says he has a lot of ammunition in his cannon. Rock is freaked out, mentions the feud with the NWO, ends with catchphrases. Booker T and Goldust get a lot of love for this time period and their chemistry. This was not one of those segments to me.
I liked it, man.
It was okay.
If anything, I felt like The Rock kind of interrupted the chemistry that the two had. But, I mean, this was more of a Rock segment, I'd say, than Booker T and Goldust segment. I thought they were a great team, man, especially because Booker's reactions to Goldust were so entertaining. I thought much of that gimmick rested on Booker.
Then we go to our finals of the King of the Ring between Brock Lesnar and Rob Van Dam. Van Dam starts off with the game plan of using leg kicks to work down Lesnar. There's a powerbomb out of the corner by Lesnar and then runs Van Dam into the corners back first. Heyman keeps yelling, title shot at SummerSlam. Maybe he'll be yelling from the crowd, UFC heavyweight title shot. Maybe that'll be the reveal if he can beat Mark Hunt.
Whoa.
It's not a one-time only deal.
Wow.
There were backbreakers to Van Dam, a bear hug. Lesnar then missed and ran shoulder first into the post. Van Dam went back to leg kicks, dropped him with a kick from the top, and then hit Rolling Thunder. Lesnar kicked out and just threw him. Van Dam hit a frog splash, but then Heyman gets on the apron and snapped Van Dam's neck on the top, one of the few physical altercations of Heyman getting involved. And then by snapping Van Dam's neck, Van Dam stumbled back and landed on top of Lesnar, and Lesnar kicked out at two. What a finish that would have been. Van Dam then knocks Heyman down on the floor and gets caught with a reverse cross as he comes off, and Lesnar catches him, hoists him up, hits the F5, and Lesnar wins. 5 minutes, 43 seconds, and now he will go to SummerSlam for the title shot. The announcers do sell it big. I thought the test match was much better than this. This was just, to me, an early Brock Lesnar match, and these two would have a better match the next month.
Well, this is a much shorter match, you know, since it was the second match that these two had both had at that night. So they really just kind of went over to the finish and didn't really have that much time to tell much of a story. Relatively short match. I thought it was just more so done for the booking.
Triple H then walks into Shawn Michaels and Kevin Nash backstage, and they tease a confrontation, but then they end up hugging. And Big Show and X-Pac are there as well, and state to Hunter that they will be there if he needs them. And not once, but twice did they refer to the championship as the strap, which was always a term they did not want. The belt. They didn't like that term either.
That's how the clique likes to talk.
The strap.
Yeah.
Bring back the strap. So this was our big tease that Hunter might join the NWO. This was before Kevin Nash tore his quad and would culminate with the tease of a DX reunion and Hunter turning on Shawn and setting up that big SummerSlam match.
So you think this was to set up the Kevin Nash Triple H feud?
That was the direction they were going, it appeared, at this point before Nash got hurt. Because Nash was coming back from another injury. I think it was his biceps or something he had suffered right when WrestleMania happened and had come back from that. And in his first match back in a like 10-man tag on Raw, his quad's blown.
Yeah, I think we're all better off forgetting this incarnation of the NWO, which by this point...
Scott Hall had left after the plane ride.
It looked nothing like the NWO. Come on. The NWO with Shawn Michaels, for a time, Booker T, Kevin Nash, Big Show, and Sean Waltman. Just, come on.
Rightly or wrongly, I mean, at this point in time, yes, Vince McMahon was the be-all, end-all, but this was Stephanie McMahon's watch when she was the head of creative. And there were a lot of big storylines that got ruined. And listen, if it had been a big success, she would deserve a lot of the credit. And with that comes blame. The Invasion, Goldberg, the NWO, the brand split in 2002. I mean, there are a lot of big things in there that you can't help but argue the fact that there was a lot of money left on the table and they didn't come close to reaching their potential. The NWO was certainly one of them. Cole and Taz then preview the main event. There's a video package with Taker just killing guys, wrapping a chair around young Randy Orton's neck. And who comes to young Orton's save but Triple H? Years before, well, at least a year and a half or so before Evolution. Hunter then beats Hogan on SmackDown to get the title shot in one of Hogan's many losses during this quick time period. And Paul Heyman is on commentary for the main event because it will be Brock taking on the winner of this title match. There was a gigantic reaction to Triple H as he came out. I don't think he was ever a bigger babyface than he was in this 2002 period when he came back at the in January, the Rumble win, and right through to this point, he was still a super hot babyface until the turn. His right elbow was all taped up because he was going to be getting arthroscopic elbow surgery right after this, and he would end up missing about a month or so of action.
So that was always the plan.
He needed surgery, yes.
By the end of this match, it seemed to feel like he was, you know, scheduled to be in the three-way coming out of this.
But. That was definitely the tease, but I think they pretty much knew that he would need some time off, and they ended up inserting Kurt into that role. So the Undertaker against Triple H for the undisputed title. Hunter clotheslines him to the floor at the start and runs Taker into the steps, and then Taker gets control. Heyman asks about Hunter's elbow, and Ross says that he has had problems and that the Undertaker made the injury even worse with a chair shot on SmackDown, which was true. Apparently the elbow had been hurt and then took a chair shot, and that messed it up even more. Heyman then asks Lawler if he would sell 6 of his 9 ex-wives for a shot at the title, which I don't think Heyman understands how divorces work, where you would have ownership over an ex-wife. But Lawler says he's only had 3 ex-wives, but yeah, he would. So that's nice. Heyman asks why Rock hasn't come out yet. He said he would be here, and then goes on to state that Brock Lesnar punked out The Rock after he won the King of the Ring, and Rock left running from the building. He took his ball and went home, is what Heyman was trying to hint at. Taker took the turnbuckle padding off. Hunter avoided it. Then Irish whips Taker into the exposed buckle back first, then hit a spinebuster for a 2 count. Hunter gets thrown into the buckle. There was a snake eyes onto it. And then immediately, Hunter just hits the Undertaker with a big knee. Then Hunter stops a choke slam, goes for the pedigree, which the crowd pops big for. Taker then blocks, catapults Hunter into Earl Hebner, who I thought was dead here. He was out for like an hour.
It was I could buy it because he took 2 heavy shots, which warranted, you know, him being out for a while.
He needed some assistance here.
Yeah.
So Hebner's out. All 3 are down, the 3rd being Hebner, when The Rock's music hits, and he comes down and he chases Paul Heyman off, and The Rock joins the commentary team. He says Lesnar never came to him, and if he did, he would have shaken his hand.
to see the reactions of some of the women behind the commentary desk at the mere sight of The Rock being so close to him was really great.
You know, The Rock said that if Lesnar had come into his locker room, he would have shaken his hand after Lesnar's big win. Next week on the Fight Network, we are going to be airing a special 2-hour special on Brock Lesnar featuring all of his UFC fights. Mm-hmm. And we've got footage of Brock Lesnar after he defeated Shane Carwin. It was The Rock who went to his locker room and shook his hand.
Wow.
Yes, there we have footage of that. So you can see it. So there, The Rock is a man of his word. Anyway, Taker gets a chair. Hunter stops him. Taker gets knocked to the floor with a clothesline. They fight there. And then Taker, just out of nowhere, takes out The Rock with a big boot, takes The Rock's chair that he had been sitting in, and Rock then grabs the chair from behind. He swings at The Undertaker, who ducks, and The Rock lays out Hunter, cracks him in the head, and then Taker sends Rock into the steel post. Hunter is bleeding from this. Hebner is still out. Taker hits a last ride in the ring when Nick Patrick runs in, and Hunter kicks out. Taker then takes out Nick Patrick and decks him. Though if there's ever a referee that you don't have to worry about a fast count, it's Nick Patrick. And then Rock comes back, attacks The Undertaker, hits a rock bottom, and Rock leaves with both men laying in the middle of the ring. Hunter struggles to climb on top of The Undertaker. Hebner, who is a few breaths away from expiring, can barely count. He goes, 1, 2, kick out by The Undertaker. Mm-hmm. I think you could have counted to 20 in between these counts. Both struggle to their feet. Hunter hits a pedigree. He goes for the cover. Somehow Earl's back out. He's lost consciousness again. Hunter tends to Earl, and this leads to The Undertaker low-blowing Hunter from behind and rolls him up, grabbing the tights as we got our signals crossed with the Molly Holly finish, and the slow cover is made, and The Undertaker pins Triple H at 23 minutes and 43 seconds. Yeah. I will say, not the finest Undertaker-Triple H match.
No, certainly not near the level of their WrestleMania appearances, not in terms of in-ring at all. But I thought this match didn't really have the same focus. It wasn't the culmination of a feud. It was more so, I felt, done to serve a purpose to building towards a vengeance match, and also in a bigger scale, the SummerSlam match between Brock and Taker. I thought Heyman early on commentary, for better or worse, really stole the show. I think, you know, taking a lot of attention away from the match, but doing so for a good purpose, to build up that Rock and Brock match on commentary. You can complain certainly about the overbooking in this match with Hebner being knocked out, but I thought for the most part it all made sense, you know, and certainly seemed to work with this crowd for all the near falls.
Yeah, and then afterwards, The Rock is shown watching the finish from the entrance, and Taker is yelling at him, Rock's yelling back, and then Rock charges the ring. They start fighting. He hits a spinebuster and the people's elbow, and then turns around and gets hit by Hunter with a pedigree as a receipt for the chair shot earlier. So we had, first, Rock's music was playing after the people's elbow. Hunter hits the pedigree. His music starts playing. Then Taker comes back to life. He chokeslams The Undertaker. And now his music plays, and he leaves with the title held up in the air.
I like the Noah storyline. Like, who's the guy here operating the music anytime somebody comes in and does so against the rules, attacks somebody, and somehow gets their music played? Like, let's say in the UFC, okay, whatever, Jason Miller comes in and shoves, who is that? Was it Nick Diaz?
That was after the Jake Shields fight with Dan Henderson.
Whatever. He comes in, shoves.
Brothers were there.
Does Jason Miller get his music played? No, the guy's an outlaw. I think the sole fact that the guy, you know, this stuff isn't supposed to happen. I'm never a fan of hearing a guy who's running in get his music played on his way out.
This was also kind of the end of the Undertaker heel run, because he would start to transition. He was still a heel for like another month, but then got involved with the Un-Americans angle, and they flipped him back to the babyface role. I mean, The Undertaker, I don't think he was a bad heel, but it was certainly, they needed babyfaces at this time, and I think the crowd, Taker as a heel was a tough fit for some.
Sure. And so this led up into the Vengeance match before SummerSlam, right?
Yeah, three-way. Which was, yeah, The Rock winning with Undertaker and Kurt, which was an awesome three-way.
Did we do that one?
I think we have. And then going into SummerSlam, which was the big crowning of Brock. And then coming out of that a week later, we brought another title out of a briefcase for Triple H on Raw. So we'll see if they can. They can't possibly screw it up like that this time around, you would hope, in 2016. Yeah. But maybe creative should listen to Review Away and analyze how things went wrong in 2002. Right. Because this was not a great, especially when you're coming off such a high, which, you know, you had this peak moment with WrestleMania 17. Yeah. You fucked up the Invasion. Yeah. And now the Invasion was squandered. It was over. Now we're going to try and basically redo WWF and WCW. And they didn't come close.
I don't know if you can. I don't think you can ever kind of recapture that.
It could have been better than this.
Certainly. I absolutely agree. I mean, there are a lot of variables at this time that I'm sure they didn't foresee, and a lot of things that they were trying that they had never tried before. I mean, what were the positives you would say that came out of this initial first few months of the brand split?
I thought having guys on separate shows was a positive because a lot of these people were getting overexposed because they were on 4 hours a week. Which,
same problems we have today?
Yeah, even more so now. And it's still going to be a problem after. I mean, 3 hours is still 3 hours on Monday. But I think getting guys where they were specific to shows, that was good. Also, pre-brand split, you had, say, five top spots. Well, by the brand extension, now you have 10. And it forced them to make new stars. And that summer, it was important when you had Triple H, even if it was a minor injury, Kevin Nash being taken out of the picture, and Kevin Nash was going to have one of those big spots. Mm-hmm. By these injuries, it forced them to say, we have got to go with a guy.
Yeah.
And Brock Lesnar, he could have had his legs cut out, and they could have said, this guy can't work main event style. He can't cut a promo. They could have listed off all these negatives, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. They said, we are going to make this guy into a star, and they were adamant about it. And that, to me, was a great part of that summer. And the brand split, there was a lot of things on paper that you can look at as positives. And I think it was the execution was difficult. And it's not as easy as just saying, oh, they should have done this, they should have done that. It's very difficult when you have certain stars, and sometimes you can't keep them on separate shows. And sometimes you do have to have crossovers, and you have to promote your events as well. You are still one company. So that becomes difficult at points. I just hope that this one is more thought out.
Yep.
Because you do have a template.
Yep.
Of what didn't work. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that's learned from. Mm-hmm. So that was the King of the Ring, 2002. Your ranking out of 10, Mr. Ting.
I mean, I give the show I thought that a lot of the matches were entertaining. Certainly nothing that was really boring, I'd consider. So I give the show a solid 7.
I give this show, I'm going to go 5.8 out of 10. I really enjoyed Angle and Hogan a lot more than I recall at the time. And the opener I thought was great with Jericho and Van Dam. But it was such a bizarre show to go back and look on because there was so much going on in this company at that point going into the summer of 2002. But let's see what our listeners had to say at the Law Message Board. By the way, new contest way, that means new secret word. And the secret word this week is Neidhart.
Oh, okay.
Neidhart. Cool.
All right.
Mick Whalen writes, I always wondered why the WWE killed off the King of the Ring pay-per-view since it used to be one of their five big pay-per-views. Watching this show gave me the answer. 2002 is an awful show, but it wasn't the fault of the tournament, which is usually why the lesser King of the Rings were seen as bad. Jericho and Van Damme opener was good, and Lesnar winning the whole thing was the right choice. The women's title match was okay, but the Molly has a fat ass angle was really tasteless and distracted from the match. Molly Holly was a truly underrated women's wrestler, especially in 2002. The main event was terrible, slow, and boring, and not even The Rock could save it. Austin leaving really put the company in a bind, but it finally forced them to go with younger guys as Lesnar would soon become the top guy at SummerSlam. Aside from the rise of Lesnar, this pay-per-view is completely skippable, and I give it 3. She's a fat-ass chance out of 10. Question for John and Wei, was this the worst King of the Ring pay-per-view in your opinion, or were others like 95 or 99 worse?
This was far from the worst.
I would say both those shows were definitely worse than this one.
The work rate by this point had is just so much better than...
This was an outstanding roster.
Than what you had in the mid-90s, you know? Some of those 90s shows just had really dull matches. And I think just overall, the wrestling was just better at this time.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think you compare the roster... Yeah, yes, 1999, business was hotter than 2002, but that locker room... There's zero comparison to the talent you had in 02 as compared to 3 years earlier.
We go to Ryan from Calgary, who says, I had a bit of free time this week, so I went and watched the earlier tournament matches in addition to watching this main card. They were almost all very short matches, and nothing was done to build up feuds or spin off into other programs. The other snippets of TV I saw were pretty cringeworthy, with the degradation of women taking up a shocking amount of TV time. Whether it was Terry Reynolds and Trish wrestling a regular match in their underwear, Vince surrounding himself with barely dressed women and speaking in barely mass sexual innuendo, or the announcers talking about Molly's butt, the clear suggestion was that women on TV are measured almost entirely in sexual terms. Watching people have to put up with that shit while they are on the job is really troubling. He can claim he's playing a character, but he's also producing that character, writing that character, hiring the supporting characters, and signing everyone's checks. This view of women is a peek into Vince's brain, and that is a really ugly place. The pay-per-view itself was nice and short and less than 3 hours on the network, and had solid matches and minimal NWO distractions and backstage segments. I thought Brock and RVD were solid, but RVD and Jericho had my match of the night. Brock takes my Putski vote this time around, but Triple H made a strong case for himself as well. 6.5 absent scepter shots out of 10. One question I didn't watch in 2002, so how does this time period rank in terms of popularity and quality of product? Angle, Eddie, Brock, Edge, and Jericho all still had their best work ahead of them, and Rock, Austin, and the NWO, and others were just coming off of their peak.
Well, popularity, I mean, they were down. Live event attendance was down big. I think it was something like 40% from the year prior, so it was a big drop in attendance. Ratings didn't plummet when the brand split happened, but they would go down after this period. But popularity, yeah, they were certainly down. This was a big departure from even 2001, where post-WrestleMania things dipped, but this was a bigger drop in 2002. So this was definitely rebuilding. When you take out Austin from the mix and you take out even a Hunter for a small period of time going into the summer. It was trying to get a lot of new guys over, some successful and some unsuccessful.
As far as the quality of the show, I think, you know...
In-ring was excellent.
Yeah, but as far as heading further into the brand split, I think it's been stated often that Raw became the shittier show, but SmackDown was excellent. I really enjoyed SmackDown for a large period in 2002.
Yeah, you would get... You know, Shawn Michaels inserted onto the Raw side later into the year as well. I mean, that picked up things on Raw, but certainly SmackDown was the focal point throughout the second half of 2002. Christian, this was a really interesting time in WWE in terms of the in-ring stuff. Some really random pairings like Guerrero, Flair, and Hogan Angle. I remember being legit surprised that Hogan tapped to Angle. It must have been one of the few times Hogan visibly tapped out, but he was in a very giving mood in 2002, putting over a lot of guys. As for the tournament, I think RVD and Jericho had the best showing, and Brock was the right guy to win, although at the time, I don't think he showed his full potential as he would just 2 months later. My final thought is that I really wasn't too impressed with the Undisputed title during its entire run. I did like how the champion was on both brands. It made them seem important, but the actual booking of them was not good. I'm amazed The Undertaker got 2 months with it when guys like Hunter and Rock barely got a month. Well, I think if Hunter had been healthy enough, they probably would have flipped the title on this show as well. I think there was a good chance of that. And that would have meant title changes.
What would the point be?
Because I think that was the direction they wanted to go. Where
Rock was the ultimate... you know, The Rock and then Brock were the ultimate goals, weren't they?
Well, I mean, Hunter was almost in a role here where he had already lost the title, and this was him going back for the... Like, Undertaker was not going to be a long-term plan. It was simply to get it off of Hogan, and, I mean, it really didn't matter, ultimately.
Yeah.
I think Hunter was certainly, though, the more over-character at this time than Undertaker was, but it really didn't matter. And you're the last one here.
Okay. Finally, we got an Eddie from Columbus, Ohio, who says, hey, guys, I heard you were doing King of the Ring 2002, and since I was there, I wanted to give my thoughts. I was always a fan of King of the Ring and liked when the winner would challenge for the title at SummerSlam, which I believe only happened in 02 in the year Mabel won it. I thought it was like SummerSlam's version of the Royal Rumble, and being named number one contender was a much better option than having a King gimmick forced upon you. I know a lot of people I talked to waiting in line to get in figured Lesnar would win it, just based on how he was being pushed at the time. Would a new person come in and challenge for the title so quickly? It wasn't something that had really been done before. As a result, I felt like the crowd was kind of indifferent on Lesnar winning. Everyone could see he was impressive, but at the same time, he'd only been on TV for not even 3 months. RVD was very over, and his match with Jericho was very solid. Angle and Hogan had the match of the night, and the crowd was definitely stunned when Hogan tapped, which I believe was his first and only tap-out loss in the WWE. The crowd really loved the Rock Booker T Goldust segment backstage. The main event was really dull and fans didn't like it. Biker Taker as a heel never worked for me. The title was being moved around each month minus this show, and Rock wasn't really able to save this match. I also remember fans excited for the NWO tease, and when they never showed up, people seemed really disappointed. I'm guessing the fans just wanted something to happen. The next day, all my friends told me how boring the show was. I really wanted to like it, being my first pay-per-view and all, but I understood where they were coming from. Being there definitely helps my opinion of this show. I can't lie and say it was all that great. I'll give it 5.5 Hogan tap-outs out of 10.
Okay. Well, thank you, folks, for all your feedback to this trip down King of the Ring memory lane. And that will bring an end to the show, so thank you for tuning in. We're going to be back next week, Way. Mm-hmm. And we are going to be reviewing a big event featuring Brock Lesnar. Okay. As he became the King of the Ring in 2002, he would go on to defend his crown in July of 2009 at an event known as UFC 100.
My God, that was 7 years ago?
Yes. Oh, July man. Of 2009, 1.6 million buys.
Wow.
Incredible amount. 1.3 million more than bought the King of the Ring.
What's the biggest drawing UFC event?
That's it.
That
UFC
was
100. Brock Lesnar.
And you think this will eclipse that? 2,200?
I think it's going to be right in the neighborhood of it. I don't know if it'll beat it.
Okay. So we'll be reviewing the biggest, the most successful MMA.
The biggest card. UFC of all time. You can totally say UFC 100 was the biggest of all time.
Featuring Brock Lesnar in the main event.
Yes, against Frank Mir in their rematch. It's cool. UFC 100 next week.
It's been a while since we've done an MMA card on this show.
Oh, I'm sure we'll get reminded.
Yeah.
So that's coming
up
next week.
You guys can take a week off if you really don't care.
That's fine. Me and Way are doing this.
Yeah.
So that's next week. George St. Pierre against Thiago Alves. And how appropriate is this? Michael Bisping versus Dan Henderson.
Wow.
The two coaches from Tough Season 9 facing off at UFC 100.
So we won't be doing the prelims. We'll be doing the main card, correct?
Maybe we'll see.
We'll go through the results.
We'll definitely, we'll run through the results and chat about what went down at UFC 100 and compare it to the UFC 200 card, which is happening just a few days after we release Review Away.
Yeah, it'd be fun to go back to that time and just think about the hype leading up to that show because, 7 years ago, I never think back to that time.
Yeah, and Brock Lesnar's speech after his fight.
Mm-hmm.
Sharing his beer of choice, which might have contradicted the title sponsor at the time.
Sharing his beer of choice, sharing his plans for the evening with one stable.
That is true.
Amaro.
So that's all coming up next week. Yeah. UFC 100 on Review Away. You can get all of our shows at liveaudiowrestling.com. If you heard the secret word on this show, you also need to hear the secret word from this past Monday's Review of Raw. And the way we're doing it this time.
Trust me. Oh, yeah. Okay.
I'll explain.
Okay, go, please.
The last time we did this, the contest ended within an hour of it being open.
What time did you post the show that time?
Probably 1 in the morning. It was done by 1:30.
Well, no, because the first entry I received was at midnight.
Okay, then midnight is around when I put the show up.
You must have put the show up, and within, I swear, less than a minute, people found the secret word and sent it to me.
So. Okay, well, I'm going to make it more open this time. I'm not going to pick the first three. It's going to be – we're going to draw them at random, okay? So you have to listen to this past Monday's Review of Raw and this show. Here are the two secret words, and this time you can message me. I won't put Wade through the decision process.
My inbox is still like 55 messages deep, and I haven't
– Oh, boy.
I haven't even looked.
So send me the two secret words, and then on
– Where?
On the Law message board, you need an account, and then you have to send me a message on the message board – with the two secret words, and then on Friday, I'm going to pick three at random at random, so it doesn't matter when you send them, but you better send them before Friday. And gotcha. Three winners will get a copy of the new WWE Extreme Rules DVD and the three-disc Scott Hall DVD that the WWE has put out.
Really? Is there a documentary in that?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Three-disc set.
And, of course, the message board is?
Lawradio.proboards.com. Free to join. And just listen to the two secret words. We'll announce the winner on Friday. And we'll be giving out some copies on the Law Sunday night. So that's going to wrap it up for us. Go to liveaudiowrestling.com and lawradio.proboards.com. And we will speak with you next week on Review Away, chatting UFC 100.
Ride, the chair shot, scrambled brains, and now the choke slam. Good God Almighty. These three men have literally beat the hell out of each other. With pride and the WWE Championship on the line, The Undertaker is still the man. He is still the toughest man in the yard. Unbelievable. I don't know if I've ever seen, look at this sight. What are we seeing? Triple H, The Rock, laid out. The Undertaker has left the game. The Undertaker has left The Rock. Lying motionless in his yard. Wow. But more importantly, The Undertaker is still the WWE Undisputed Champion as the King of the Ring.